Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Portland Clean Energy Initiative, Measure 26201, is an innovative Portland ballot measure that will create $3 million in funding for local clean energy projects, including rooftop solar, energy efficiency, housing upgrades, and community gardens. The funds will be raised via a 1% surcharge on billion-dollar retailers with over $500,000 in annual Portland revenue. Priority for the projects will be given to those most impacted by climate change, low-income people and communities of color. Today, we talk with Damon Mott-Story, clean energy organizer, and Dr. Patricia Kohlberg, who is also our engineer for this show, and they're both with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, about the health benefits of passing Measure 26201 for the entire city, as well as its potential to remedy racial and economic health disparities in the city of Portland. Damon is not here yet. He should be here in 8 minutes. So in the meantime, Patsy, welcome to Locus Focus from the other side.
Good morning, Barbara. Thrilled to be here.
And you are you and Damon are with Physicians for Social Responsibility. You're both doctors. I'm wondering, what is your interest in the Portland Clean Energy Initiative from the perspective of a physician?
Well, I took a very public health look at the Portland Clean Energy Initiative and at climate change as it affects Portland in particular. What we know is that the three major effects that climate change is going to unleash on Portland, and these are things we've already experienced, are smoke from wildfires, extreme heat days, and flooding. And what I find particularly alarming about these changes that are coming is that the people who are most vulnerable in our communities, in the under-resourced, disenfranchised communities, communities of color, houseless people, low-income communities, those folks are the ones who are going to be hit hardest by these climate impacts for a whole variety of reasons.
Well, the thing that is exciting to a lot of people about the Portland Clean Energy Initiative is it's the first time, at least that I'm aware of, that an initiative to address climate change via taxing, basically taxing some of the polluters or businesses that can afford to help subsidize the impacts that climate change is going to have on low-income people and communities of color. This is the first initiative that's really been driven by communities of color. I know this is something we should really be talking with Damon, but Patsy, can you talk at all about the motivators for this initiative and how it sets it apart from previous efforts to try to address this problem?
Well, the kind of traditional environmental community has really stepped back and let the coalition of communities of color and other low-income-oriented organizations, organizing organizations, take the lead in this initiative. And I think that's a very important advance in our organizing efforts, because I think those communities that are most affected really need to be empowered to be organizing themselves to resist what's coming, and also to become more a part of the political process. What we know is that people who live in blighted neighborhoods with poor social cohesion, people moving in and out all the time, not a lot of resources, not jobs, those folks do not really take part in the political process in the ways that they should. They're just too distracted, and we really need those folks now to build democracy and get this country turning around in a different direction. Well, that's what excites me about the program.
Well, let's
the
talk.
Initiative.
Let's talk a little bit about specifically how these communities are more impacted by climate change than people who live in more stable, more upper middle class, and perhaps more resilient parts of the city?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is, and they're intertwined, one is that these populations already bear a bigger burden of disease. On any measure that you care to look at, from infant mortality to depression and anxiety to cancer rates to heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, interpersonal violence, smoking, substance abuse, any of those measures, these communities are not faring well. And their life expectancy is significantly lower. They also live in these communities, as I mentioned before, that where the air is already polluted, where there is not a green canopy, where there may not be safe places to exercise for the kids, where they may be food deserts, where you can't buy healthy food. And so they're strapped at every turn in terms of improving their health. And the worst aspect of this is the social disconnect. There is a lot of research that's coming out now that looks at the impact of living in poverty and living in a racist society, if you're a person of color, to show that it has a significant impact on your health. And we know that if all the social conditions were equalized across all folks, all of those differences in health outcomes would be erased. In other words, it's not about clinical care. It's not about stopping smoking. It's about making our neighborhoods and our jobs livable for everyone.
That's kind of interesting, because one of the things that I've heard a lot in a lot of different cities is that it's hard for the health statisticians to separate from the statistical noise, the lifestyle problems of low-income people, the ways in which kind of you blame the victim, and the more environmental issues. And this was actually, I talked to the mayor of Richmond, California, a couple years ago about the fire, the massive fire at the Chevron refinery in 2012, and about the health impacts. And he threw that one out as like, well, it's really hard to distinguish, you know, how much of it is from the living sedentary lives indoors and smoking cigarettes and eating junk food, and how much of it was from the horrible toxins from the Chevron Richmond fire. So how do we separate that out, and how would this initiative perhaps start to separate the noise from the reality?
Well, I don't think that the way to go is to try to separate out those effects, but rather to understand that those what we call lifestyle choices are yet another effect of living in poverty and living under racism. There is a ton of literature out there to show that smoking, substance abuse, interpersonal violence, all those things are a result of stress and crappy living conditions. They're not, it's really naive and misguided to say that these are somehow choices that people make. I mean, what does it mean? What about, you know, a person who is diabetic and there's no grocery within 4 miles that sells fresh produce? What about an asthmatic who lives with a partner who smokes? What about the person who's overweight and there's no safe place to exercise? You take away people's options and sometimes even force them into making poor choices. And it's no, you know, smoking and alcohol abuse or substance abuse, those are ways to calm your anxiety and treat your own depression. It's just not good to think of them as choices.
And I have a feeling that Damon may be coming very shortly. But in the meantime, as Patsy's kind of doing dual jobs right now as engineering, doorkeeper, and interview subject. So was that Damon who's showing up? Okay, unfortunately not. Hopefully Damon will be here soon. There seems to be, it's kind of obvious that there's a whole new layer of issues for low-income people with the onslaught of climate change factors. And one of the things you mentioned at the beginning was the increase in smoky air from wildfires. And we certainly have been experiencing that the last three out of the last 4 summers. So there's two things that I think are really different in living in Portland now and living in Portland 20 years ago. Living in Portland 20 years ago, you did not need air conditioning. There were a few hot days during the year, and there were all kinds of ways to remedy that. But now, last summer, I think we had at least a month with temperatures over 90 degrees, and we had some of the worst air, I think the next to worst air ever experienced, the worst one being the year before when the Eagle Creek fire was burning. So how does this disproportionately affect low-income people, and what kind of remedy can there be?
Well, you mentioned one already. The older housing stock is rarely air conditioned. And one of the things that PCEI would help with is funding for weatherization and air conditioning of homes so that people can have a comfortable environment. Heat is very stressful, particularly with people who suffer from chronic conditions and can make their conditions much worse. The other thing to note is that if you map Portland out and look at the air quality, which is already shockingly poor in Portland, you find that the areas where the air quality is worse, primarily due to diesel particulate matter from traffic, that's one of the big drivers of poor air quality. The corridors of where the air is worse tend to be these low-income communities and communities of color. So not only are they already suffering from more chronic bronchitis or emphysema or heart disease, they're also being exposed to more industrial pollutants and traffic pollutants. And then you layer a forest fire, smoke from a forest fire on top of that, and it can be literally deadly.
So how would this initiative really materially help in changing and improving these people's lives and also helping them to integrate more into a community?
Well, one of the things that we know can help improve the air is a green canopy. And so simply taking those neighborhoods and putting in more green spaces is going to make a lot of difference there. The other things that can help, of course, is weatherization, is sealing up homes so that when they stay inside, the air doesn't get in as much, and that can help. And what was the other part of your question?
Well, that pretty much sums it up, I guess. And we have Damon here, so he takes off his pack and sits down in front of the microphone, and put your headphones on, and we're all set to go. So I want to introduce now David Mott-Story, who's your, well, what you gave me was clean energy organizer. Is that your title?
That's correct.
And so you're basically one of the campaign managers for the Clean Energy Initiative.
That's right. I've been serving as the communications co-coordinator for the last several months.
And well, I'm kind of curious, what's your relationship with Patsy?
Yeah, so I'm a clean energy organizer at Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Patsy is one of our all-star volunteers. We've been very lucky to have her as a member of our Healthy Climate Action Team for a long time.
And one thing that's been really intriguing me, and I've talked about this with a couple people in Physicians for Social Responsibility, is the focus that PSR has had in the last few years on climate change. Because back when I first was involved with PSR, back in the, I guess, early 80s, it was all about nuclear war. So I've talked to a couple of people. Do you see a connection between PSR's obsession with nuclear war? And later on, they also started appreciating that nuclear power was a danger, too.
Right.
With that, and now the focus is on climate change.
Absolutely. I think this really ties into that United Nations report that came out that says we have really only about the next 12 years to mitigate global warming to the point of only getting to 1.5 degrees Celsius worldwide. This is really a kind of a there's no turning back sort of a public health crisis, right? It's in there are very scary parallels between, you know, the use of nuclear weapons and sort of irreversible climate damage, right? And so we seek to prevent what we cannot cure, right?
Well, I had an interesting dinner conversation a couple nights ago with there are three old duffers at the table, including myself, and then two young men in their late 20s. And we were talking about what's the worst thing to grow up with, climate chaos or nuclear war? I don't think we answered that question. But I'm kind of curious, what's your take? I mean, because we sort of came to the conclusion, I think, that there's actually a bigger existential threat from climate chaos. Mm. The thing with nuclear war is it was preventable. Mm. It was always preventable. Mm-hmm. And so far, we've prevented it. Mm. But
well, it's a wonderful question, I think. I often think about poet Kathy Jetnil Kijner when I consider this question, right? So she is a Marshallese activist and poet who has talked very powerfully about the ways that climate change has impacted the Marshall Islands, specifically also the nuclear weapons testing site on the Marshall Islands, right? And so that's really a case study in the ways that America's nuclear legacy combined with America and the other, you know, industrialized countries' impact on the climate have intersected to affect people's lives worldwide, right? So I don't think we need to necessarily choose which one is the most more destructive, but we can work on both of those issues together.
And actually, I think the fact that the intersection of the first region of the world other than Japan to be really impacted by nuclear weapons. I mean, actually, I think it was more devastating in the Marshall Islands than it was much bigger bombs. And to sort of see, it's almost like climate chaos, even though it's not a direct stepchild or grandchild of nuclear war, it's, I think, maybe the same mentality that's kind of led us to an equally horrible possible future.
I agree, yeah.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about the Portland Clean Energy Initiative with two members of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Dr. Patricia Kullberg, who is my engineer and today's guest, along with Damon Mott-Story, who is the clean energy organizer for Physicians for Social Responsibility. Well, I wanted to talk some about the nuts and bolts of of Measure 26201. And Patsy, I want you to jump in too, so you guys can interrupt each other or do whatever you want to kind of get this going. But first of all, I wanted to talk about how it works, and I'll let you, as the campaign.
Absolutely, yes.
Talk, Damon, about how this measure would work and what sets it apart from other efforts in the past to try to find a way to address climate change in the state in a meaningful way.
Absolutely. Thanks for the question. So this is a really unique approach, and I've been really excited to be a part of working on it. The Portland Clean Energy Initiative, Measure 26201, if we find out that we've passed it tomorrow, which I sure hope we do, what it will do is set up a 1% business license surcharge on billion-dollar retailers that make over $500,000 in the city of Portland. So you have to meet both of those two criteria in order for that surcharge to apply.
So examples, who would some of these companies be?
Right. So we know
Walmart's one, I know.
That's right. Walmart's one of them. U.S. Bank is another. Comcast, for example. So we're really seeing these big multinational corporations are really the only ones that are likely to meet both of those two criteria.
So Powell's Books won't be part of it.
Powell's Books won't be part of it. That's right.
Or New Seasons.
exactly, right. Yeah, those companies don't even come close to making $1 billion per year in sales.
Because I'm thinking about the business tax that was tried and lost and fought very furiously by Powell's Books. There's a perception the opponent for this is the Portland is for people for an affordable Portland.
It's a really ridiculous name. Yeah, it's the opposition PAC has called themselves "Keep Portland Affordable," as if it were affordable for everyone right now.
But the other part is, what are they promulgating in terms of fears that this initiative would do?
Yeah, good question. And really the spokesperson, the mouthpiece of the opposition has been Andrew Hone, the president and CEO of the Portland Business Alliance. That's basically the Greater Portland's Chamber of Commerce. And
next week the show's about them.
Uh-huh, yeah. So that'll give your listeners a little, stay
teaser,
tuned.
Right.
It's exactly what you said. It's been a lot of fear-mongering coming from them. It's been really shameful, I think, to see our business alliance here in Portland playing up on Portlanders' fears of being able to afford basic needs and services, when in fact, this is so hyper-targeted as a surcharge that there's no credible empirical data that shows that a surcharge of this type could possibly impact consumer prices.
So my Comcast bill's not going to go up?
No, it's not. Well, if it does, it'll be their fault and not the fault of this surcharge.
What do you mean it'll be their fault?
Well, I mean, they get to set their prices nationally, right? And I've heard a little bit of scuttlebutt from a Comcast employee who was my friend's Lyft driver the other day, who said that probably Comcast is going to be increasing their prices nationwide soon. And that's really egregious when you consider that Trump just gave Comcast and a bunch of these other companies a really enormous tax cut, and we didn't see prices go down when that tax cut happened.
Yeah, actually, they raised our fee about $1 less. Yeah. It was very weird. I mean, it's sort of the frog in the boiling water kind of thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, but all of these companies set their prices in large regional bases, right? Like, you're not going to suddenly pay more for an iPad in Portland than in Vancouver. It's going to be the same price because of the way that these retailers do things.
But can Comcast blame the initiative in Portland for why they had to increase their prices nationwide?
it would be a lie.
Well, it doesn't stop a lot of people, like our president, right. Or somebody else's president. But
a friend of mine once said, oftentimes the groups that are trying to avoid paying their fair share are unburdened by the truth.
Well, the other thing that I'm interested in, Patsy, you might want to jump in on this too. I kind of want to compare and contrast the initiative here in Portland,
sure.
26201, with Washington's basically clean
1631,
right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And which is taking a different tact. I wanted to talk about what's the difference sure. in the approaches and how much similarity is there between the two initiatives.
Yeah, and if you don't mind, I'll briefly summarize what the money from that surcharge will do.
Right.
So that 1% business license surcharge on billion-dollar retailers will go into a fund, and that will raise approximately $30 million per year. And that money can be spent on three different pools. It can be on rooftop renewable energy, energy efficiency weatherizations and home upgrades. It can be on urban green spaces, like more tree canopies for urban heat islands that see a much hotter rise in temperature in the summers. You know, so that's a very multifaceted approach to handling our own city's impact on greenhouse gas emissions, but also preparing our neighborhoods to be more resilient in the face of extreme weather and the effects of climate change. So it's really a smart two-pronged approach to reducing our city's carbon footprint while also preparing the most susceptible to those people who are the most susceptible to the health impacts of climate change to be more resilient and ready for those impacts.
Now, how about 1631? Because that has takes a different approach.
That's right. So 1631 is basically a carbon fee that sets like a price on carbon, and that's going to there's a little bit of similarities because the revenue from that fee is going to go into a fund that will be used to build out good clean energy projects and job training.
Actually, very similar ones, it seems. That's
right.
One thing I noticed, that, mm-hmm. that the outcomes are very similar, but
right.
the source of the revenue is very different.
That's
and,
right.
And that's what seems to be more contested in Washington.
And
yeah. it's what's driving, I think it's up to $31 million that the oil industry has put into trying to defeat 1631.
It's been record-breaking on ballot measure campaign finance laws. But let's compare and contrast here. So in Portland, the people paying the surcharge are retailers, regardless of what industry you're in. In Washington state, it's emitters, right? So it has, you have to meet a certain emission amount in order to pay the fee there, right? So that it's a flat, per ton of carbon fee.
I'm curious, has the Portland initiative, it hasn't incited $31 million in opposition funding. But,
that's right.
But how well-funded is the opposition? I've actually seen very little of them. I think I mm-hmm. might have gotten one mailer from them, and I've seen no signs saying no on 26201. Actually, no signs on yes on 26201 either, because the number for the ballot measure is not on the signs.
That's right. So I'll take this moment to remind listeners that the yes on Portland Clean Energy Fund, that's at measure 26201 that those signs are referencing.
Yeah, so it's 26201. It's the last of the three city ballot measures.
That's right. Thank you.
We also, at this time, we take a moment to remind people what tomorrow is.
Yeah, tomorrow is Election Day. Ballots are due by 8 p.m., you must, at this point, drop off your ballot at an official Dropbox site. It's too late to put it in the mail, so you can go to any branch of the Multnomah County Library or to 1040 Southeast Morrison Street, where the Multnomah County Office of Elections is.
Now, I'm going to throw this next question out to both you and Patsy, because I'd like to get Patsy's response. I actually ran into Patsy yesterday in the neighborhood and mentioned this to her, so this is going to be a surprise for
right.
you, Damon. I was out canvassing on Saturday.
Wonderful. Thank
and,
you.
And Actually, I was not canvassing for this initiative, but I can't say who I was canvassing for, obviously, because I can't talk about that stuff on the air. But I ran into a woman who was very strongly Democrat and was, like, liking everything that I was talking about, except that she said she voted no on 26201.
Oh.
She also voted no on the affordable housing. I'm not sure whether it was a state measure or the city measure. And she voted no on the affordable housing because she thought it doesn't really approach the problem that she sees with affordable housing, which is you need to go after the developers and not just build a whole lot of housing.
Mm.
And we didn't get into a lot of it, but with her problem with 26201, she thought it was going to be putting a lot of solar panels on these new expensive condominium units that are going up. She didn't know what the money was going to be used for. So I tried to explain it to her, and I got the feeling, she said she just didn't see it anywhere. And I got home and I started looking over all the information I'd gotten on from emails and mm-hmm. stuff. And I'm assuming mm-hmm. it's the same as on the website. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, it's pretty clear. But I mm-hmm. feel like for some reason, this particular woman who struck me as being a pretty smart woman didn't get it. So I wonder how we can make that clear in the next 35 minutes here.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to do that. That is one of the other very unique things about the Portland Clean Energy Initiative is that if passed, it would be Oregon's first ever environmental initiative that was drafted by and led by communities of color in the state of Oregon. And that's very intentional. I mean, the 50% of the funds for renewable energy projects will have to be spent on low-income households and communities of color. And that is because those demographics are the most impacted by the health impacts of climate change.
Yeah, and let me jump in here.
Yes, please.
We talked a little bit about that before, but one of the points that I want to make that I think gets glossed over in this discussion is that this initiative is a small step, but one we can build on toward building healthy communities in our city. And I want to stop and define what a healthy community is, because I don't think people quite get the scope of that. It's a place where the water and the air is clean, where the housing stock is safe, where you have parks and green spaces, where there are plentiful jobs, where the schools are resourced. But the key, I think, to and what makes healthy communities really important is that in healthy communities, people are engaged. They know their neighbors. These are stable neighborhoods. They vote. They tend to volunteer. They get involved. We are in the middle of a crisis of democracy in our country. And one of the ways to get people democratically engaged, and I'm talking now not just about voting, but about being parts of organizations that uplift our neighborhoods, building healthy neighborhoods gets people to a place where they get involved in those ways. And that is really critical right now.
So what's the mechanism for people, particularly in low-income, unresilient, and rather neglected neighborhoods, to become engaged in their neighborhoods and in the community and in the political process? I mean, how does this initiative directly do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the cool thing is that once we pass it, if we pass it, the different nonprofits in the city that already do a lot of this really important weatherization work and renewable development work and local agriculture and green spaces work, exist in our city. That includes organizations like Verde and Coley and the Native American Youth and Family Center. They need more resources, but they're already really well connected in with the communities that need these projects the most. And so that's going to allow us to really make the connection strong between this new and innovative source of funding and being able to find out who needs it most and most urgently.
So who's going to be administering the funding?
Great question. So we modeled this off of the Portland Children's Levy, which has been very successful and reauthorized by voters. It's going to be a 9-person committee that is appointed by the city council. And that 9-person committee will reflect the broad diversity of Portland, both in race and age and what part of the city they live in, and as well as expertise in the various issue areas that one needs to be well-versed in order to make, you know, good investment decisions on these renewable energy and job training projects. So that 9-person committee will then send their recommendations to the Portland City Council, and they'll have the final oversight over whether or not a project gets funded.
So then again, the question is, how do the people who, as Patsy was describing, who live in these communities, mm-hmm. who do not have time to be engaged because they're just barely able to keep themselves alive, and they're mm-hmm. dealing with all kinds of health issues, and they're living in moldy apartments and mm-hmm. all kinds of particulate matter in the air that they breathe, and probably a lot less physical security than people in more middle-class neighborhoods would have, how are they going to become part of the democratic process? And Patsy, I wondered, have you thought this part through?
Yeah, I have. I think that when you start to solve some daily challenges for people, when they're not having, when they've got their home weatherized and their heating bills go down and they're not economically stressed, and they see an organization in the community that's come in and given them a hand, I think that that creates bonds in a community and helps get people engaged. You can imagine all sorts of benefits that relieve this just the stress of daily living that this might offer to these folks. And then it becomes a little bit of a spiraling process, you know, as lives get better. People have more time, more energy, more personal energy to get out and get involved. Plus, they see their neighbors involved. And so it feeds on itself. Community gardens, for example, are a great way. You build a lot more community gardens. You get people out there, you know, working together side by side. It's not just a green space and a healthy food thing. It's also a place where people connect and can talk about their communities and what is important to them and start being engaged in building their own communities.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about the Portland Clean Energy Initiative with two members of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Dr. Patricia Kullberg, who is my engineer and today's guest, along with Damon Mott-Story, who is the clean energy organizer for Physicians for Social Responsibility. I want to get back to the opponents of this, because mm-hmm. I'd like to get a sense, like, what is their game plan, and do you feel like it's had any effect in dampening your message?
We've seen this game plan before. Anytime that the people of Oregon come together and say, it's time for these corporations to pay their fair share towards making our communities better places to live, they do the same thing. They pour hundreds of thousands of dollars into really negative, fear-mongering, scare-based advertising that is meant to make people feel fearful about things that we have no reason to be fearful of. And so, you know, we saw the same thing with Measure 97 2 years ago in 2016, and we're seeing it again now. There's really no grassroots support behind the opposition to Measure 26201, the Portland Clean Energy Initiative.
But Measure 97 was defeated.
That's right, but that was a statewide measure. And in the city of Portland, Portland voters approved that by over 60%. So this one is a very localized city ballot measure. And, you know, if precedent is anything to go off of, it's like we've already seen that Portland voters are very resilient to this kind of fear-based campaigning.
Well, just from the canvassing that I've been doing the last few weeks, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of signs. I mean, as I said before, I have not seen one no sign for this. And when I talk to people about candidates and other issues, it all comes back. This is one of the things that comes up. And except for the one person I met on Saturday, people are very supportive of this. So it seems like the support is here, and it seems like a smart move to be starting in Portland. But I wonder, can this be a movement that can stretch out to the rest of the state?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's one of the great things about it is that it's an example. You know, it's something that we're doing really on a pretty small scale, as big as it sounds. But it can be a model for what other localities can do.
I'm also wondering if it's a step towards doing an initiative like 1631, which from my reading of it and looking at it, it feels like there's some flaws in that one and there's some loopholes. Mm-hmm. And so the opponents of that have jumped at it saying, oh, it's giving a break to coal, which is not exactly accurate.
That's right.
But it seems like it's easier to target the weak spots in 1631 than it is in 26201. I'm wondering if you think that that's also kind of true.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, 26201 here in Portland is going to nicely complement other climate strategies for the whole state of Oregon. It's not that we don't care about the rest of the state. It's that we believe that Portland could be a model for how other jurisdictions can take this kind of action.
So how do you see, what would be the next steps after 26201 is passed?
Yeah, for one thing, I mean, the projects, you know, Portland being Oregon's greatest city means that, largest city, that is, by population, it means that we'll be able to focus those funds in the most densely populated part of the state, right? So that's, one prime example, right, that means that there will be more funds available when, you know, for example, if there were some kind of, statewide clean energy fund that was set up by the Oregon legislature, you know, they wouldn't have to focus. They would be able to have a bit greater impact of their funds on focusing on rural areas, in part because they'd be able to leverage the fact that there's existing funding in the city of Portland.
Well, one of the things that I wonder about is that there is, unlike 1631, where there's a direct link between carbon emissions and being taxed for it, mm-hmm. which is something a lot of people are saying, we really need to put a price on carbon, mm-hmm. that here it's actually not about carbon emissions. It has to do with just creating a fund from businesses that can afford it for all these things that are either some of it to mitigate and to prevent the worst excesses of climate change and some of it to build resilience to it. But it seems like we really, the thing that they, that 1631 is looking at is ways to really slow down and stop our carbon emissions.
Yes and no. I mean, the Clean Energy Initiative here in Portland is focusing on major retailers, in part because those retailers often have very long and very carbon-intensive supply chains that don't often get accounted for if you just look at Oregon-based emissions. And so this is, you know, this is our answer to, you know, another thing here is that 70% of Oregon state revenue comes from individual income taxes, right? And so, like, we know that these corporations can afford it, and we know that they're not really paying for and accounting for the very dirty supply chains that that source their products.
Can we talk a little bit maybe also about the initiative? I think it's a statewide initiative in California, which I'm not prepared to talk about, but I believe it's one that is aimed more at very simply put, public control over energy systems. And that's really where we need to be going, because until the public is, you know, the people are in control, it's going to be very, very hard to continually fight these fossil fuel industries. Can you, either of you, speak to that?
I don't know much about it. How about you, Damon?
I really don't. I'm nodding my head only because I agree that the underlying issue here is we need energy democracy.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I think that that's a really big thing. By the way, the word I was thinking of, and I want to back up a little bit, was carbon offsets.
Because
that's an issue. I mean, that was the big panacea for many years. And that's one thing that that I think that 1631 sort of is saying, this is not about carbon offsets. You can't offset carbon emissions. You got to pay for them.
Right.
And I think that's one of the strain. And actually, I think in California, their carbon tax has a lot of carbon offsets in it. So maybe we're at a new generation of thinking about how we legislate really reducing carbon emissions and not be caught up in the kind of the marketplace method that British Columbia uses and that California uses.
I'm glad you brought up offsets, because this is one of the moments where it's really helpful to look at these issues from a health perspective. When you look at quantifying the health benefits of reducing carbon emissions, often we see that it's the pollutants that also are in those same smokestacks that are very, very profoundly impacting people's health. And so there's the indirect impacts on health of climate change, but there's also the very direct immediate impacts of burning fossil fuels on our health and livelihoods right by the source of that pollution. When you offset that carbon emission, that pollution source is still there and still impacting often very low-income communities and communities of color. So that's why it's really important for us to go 100% renewable. The city of Portland made that commitment last year, and the Clean Energy Initiative is a way to get there.
Actually, I was thinking back to Richmond, California, that it's been a big concern there, because they were trying to have the state, well, actually, this San Francisco Bay Clean Air Agency, or whatever it's called, that sets the emissions for each region. And they were only looking at carbon emissions. And it was so Chevron refinery in Richmond was getting away with horrible particulate emissions because they could offset their carbon emissions. And I think that this is something where we really have to look at what you're saying, that we have to recognize that we have to work locally, probably, and that we do better by offsetting our own emissions locally, getting rid of the emissions, as opposed to saying, oh, we're going to plant trees over in the Amazon, and that'll make up for how much we're emitting here.
No, an overall reduction is what we need, and fast.
Yeah, the faster we build up renewable energy infrastructure here in the city of Portland, the faster that we can reduce the need for burning fossil fuels all over the place.
glad to get back to what Patsy just mentioned a little bit ago about energy democracy. And that seems like that also, I mean, that's tied in with emissions. But Patsy, what is your vision for having like a democratic energy distribution system and generation for that matter?
Well, I think it starts with public power. You know, we had a public power initiative whenever it was several years ago on the ballot, I believe, that failed through a lot of the usual, you know,
shenanigans.
Yeah, you know, just obscuring the real issues. But I think if we could take over from PGE and its and corporations like that,
Pacific Power.
Yeah, Pacific Power. Then the whole thing becomes within our grasp. It becomes our energy and how we're going to produce it and how we're going to use it, and it's not filling the corporate coffers.
But I do have a concern about that. I have these discussions with friends up in Washington State where most of the communities have public power now, including like Tacoma, which is, I think, more public power than Seattle is. But it was an infamous public power company in Washington State in the 70s and early 80s called WPS, Washington Public Power Supply System. Was responsible for raising,
yes,
I don't know, trillions of dollars in debt around its five nuclear reactors.
It was the
reactors.
Largest municipal bond default in U.S. history at the time.
And actually, Canby, Oregon was part of WPS. And they, mm-hmm. I mean, so they suffered. I mean, it was definitely very debilitating for all the ratepayers as well as for the communities.
And that was for nuclear power plants, right? And so that should be a firm reminder to our listeners that, you know, nuclear is not a solution to climate change. It's incredibly costly and incredibly dangerous.
But the other part of it is it also shows that public power systems by themselves aren't innately good. It
right.
really depends on who's directing them.
Right.
Well, it depends, again, on whether you're doing your job in organizing a community to hold an institution's feet to the fire.
Yeah. And I think one of the most important things to remember is that any energy democracy system needs to make sure that low-income households and communities of color are there at the table, deciding for themselves what they're going to be getting their power from and how that process is going to go.
And another part about public power, the public power in Washington is largely dependent on hydro. So I tell my friends in Tacoma when they're talking about how clean their hydro is, I said, yeah, but, you know, it's killing the salmon in
right.
the Columbia River, which in turn is killing the orcas in the Puget Sound.
Right.
So I think that we have to think beyond hydro as well and understand the downside of hydro.
Right.
Well, the upside of climate change may be that solar power becomes a better force or a more likely force.
I thought it was going to get wetter here.
Well, only in the winter.
We just store all that. Well, actually, the battery storage is getting much better. So how do you see that the Clean Energy Initiative would change things besides building all this infrastructure, basically, for low-income communities? Mm-hmm. How else would it make changes that it really needed to have a fossil fuel-free future?
I'm really glad you asked. I mean, I think this is a coalition unlike anything Portland politics has ever seen before, right? This is hundreds of groups coming together from labor, from affordable housing advocates, communities of color, traditional environmental groups, and so many small businesses. And it's really, it's a political force to be reckoned with.
It's very impressive.
Absolutely. And I think that that means that this movement behind this initiative, you know, when we win, I'm going to manifest it here.
Yes.
it'll be step one along mm-hmm. a road of ensuring that that the people of Portland have a democratic say over how we generate our electricity and also, you know, more broadly, how we build up our communities in a way that is inclusive and that does not gentrify people and displace people out of them. I think it's a broader and multifaceted approach and really shows how there's a watershed of benefits that come from when you address and take action on climate change from an environmental justice-based perspective.
Yeah, and just let me emphasize, too, that when we win, it's really the start of the struggle because it's going to open up a whole new arena within which we can struggle. And it's going to be very important not to just say, okay, we won this and now we can go home. Now's the time to build even more.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about the Portland Clean Energy Initiative with two members of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Damon Mart-Story, who's the clean energy organizer, and Patricia Kohlberg. Well, in the last few minutes that we have here, let's talk about the future past post-26201 actually winning. What are some of the steps that would be taken that would ensure would ensure, for one thing, that these marginalized communities of color and low-income communities would actually become an integrated part of our community, a citywide community, and would become empowered and be able to actually take control over their own lives? And also, what kinds of energy projects would be created out of this that could really make sure that Portland makes its goal to be 100% renewables by, 2050?
That's right. What are some of the next steps? I mean, I think one of the really encouraging things that I'm seeing is that communities of color and low-income folks are already getting more engaged as a process of this campaign coming together. And so you've got, I remember very distinctly that Opal environmental justice members were going out, you know, and their Bus Riders Unite union was collecting signatures to get this on the ballot by riding on the bus with people, you know, and talking, having conversations there, right? So people are already starting to get more mobilized and more engaged. And I love to talk about the Rose Community Development Project at Southeast Division and 82nd Avenue. That's in process construction project that will be affordable housing units and community organizing space. And if we could make sure that all spaces like that were powered by rooftop solar and were, you know, really state-of-the-art, well-weatherized so that their utility bills are low, you know, we could see that also being sort of a charging center for the local, you know, people experiencing houselessness could come in and, you know, get what they need in order to charge their cell phones and do what they need to do. We're talking
about getting them housing.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and one of the best ways to address the housing issue, right, and homelessness is to make sure that people don't ever leave their homes in the first place. You know, so for those people who are paying upwards of $200 or $300 a month on heating their homes in the winter times, making sure that those houses are really well insulated. And that they get rooftop solar so that they don't have an electricity bill, right? Things like that will really help to bring costs down. And as Patsy was saying, it's going to allow people to have more time and more strength to be able to go out and be more involved members of the community.
Well, and the other thing I think is that the coalition presents a vision for Portland that's different, that's hopeful. That is inclusive, and people don't step in or step up to a struggle unless they see a vision and they see something that's possible. So that to me is also a very important part of this struggle that goes beyond simply providing solar panels or insulation to a home or more trees.
You know, I got a phone call last night from a Republican senator, Oregon senator, state senator, and basically telling me that Oregon was being taken over by Portland liberals and we needed to put a stop to that and so vote Republican.
Oh, my God.
And it struck me, first of all, like, we got the wrong person here. Why are you calling us? And thinking, I think that your phone lists are not very well targeted. And it made me get this sense of, like, that the Oregon Republican Party back when I came to Portland had some pretty good people in it, like Mark Hadfield and Tom McCall. It's a very different party now than it was 40, 50 years ago. But I also thought it seemed that there was something at this phone call that had a desperation.
Oh,
and
interesting.
And made me think, well, maybe things have really changed in Oregon.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, Oregon sort of touted itself as being this progressive green place in the 70s, but in fact, it really wasn't. It was just, there were things good that were happening, like the bottle bill and the land use laws, but not a whole lot else after that.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if this initiative and the support that it's getting, the widespread support, is an indication that maybe Oregon is really growing up.
I think
so.
You're right. Yeah, and I hope so too. And I'm glad that you mentioned this, in part because I think another piece of evidence of that desperation is the really horrible racist anti-immigrant measure that Oregonians for Immigration Reform, it's a terrible Southern Poverty Law Center designated hate group that has put forward Measure 105 that I hope every listener will vote no on tomorrow. it's I think a really strong indicator that there is this desperate white nationalist, white supremacist sentiment that in some parts of this state, and they're trying to make that make our state a less welcoming and less inclusive place.
And anti-democratic.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, we might as well just run down those statewide ballot initiatives sure. while we're at it, because we can talk about initiatives on the air, advocacy or not.
That's right.
Unlike candidates who we can't talk about. And I found it interesting when I was going out canvassing and people... It was like, I voted for everything right and against everything wrong.
Yeah.
But it's so, and it's interesting that the city initiatives are quite progressive.
That's
and
right.
The state initiatives, with the exception of one, are mm-hmm. worse than regressive. So
that's right.
Let's just run down, I guess, what we got, a total of 8 initiatives that mm-hmm. we can talk about.
All right. Here's my speed round.
Okay.
So let's start statewide. Measure 102 is part of a 2-part housing, affordable housing push. This would help leverage both public and private funding to build affordable housing for people statewide. Very important.
So is this going to be a tax, or how is it figured out?
No, it just kind of it amends the Constitution to allow us to leverage more different types of funds for affordable housing. That's what Measure 102 will do.
Now, so, it had some criticism. I remember reading the Rural Organizing Project's ballot.
Yeah, thing. It's not my favorite way to go about this problem, but it's a big problem we have on our hands, right? Statewide, we need a lot more affordable housing. It's not just in Portland.
When Street Roots came out in favor of it, I figured, okay, they know
right.
about affordable housing
that's
as much
right.
as anybody
right.
else does.
So let's try to get through the rest of the
right.
measures here.
Okay.
103 is a really insidious attempt to carve out exemptions in our state constitution for special interests. This is largely funded by Kroger, Safeway, the big grocery interests, who would like you to think that there is a grocery tax out there. There is not a grocery
or
tax.
Or lurking. It's going to happen any day
right,
now.
That's
lurking.
Right. That's right. So we're encouraging folks to vote no on Measure 103. It would make it harder for the state to raise revenue for really vital services like the Oregon Health Plan. Similarly, Measure 104 would make it such that the 3/5 majority, the supermajority in the Oregon State Legislature, would apply to anything that raises revenue. And that would really paralyze the Oregon State Legislature in passing bills that improve infrastructure statewide.
So that right now, actually for tax measures, there's been a 3/5 mm-hmm. majority since like 1990 or something
for
like that.
For a long time, yeah.
Measure 5, I think, instituted that. But
correct.
This would make it so that if you needed to raise fees on mm-hmm. driver's licenses or mm-hmm. anything, any small thing.
Right, good example. So we're hoping folks will vote no on 104
as
well.
We don't want their fees raised on driver's licenses.
That's right, but yeah. So, and 105, we've already discussed, that would repeal Oregon's 30-year-old state sanctuary law, limiting the use of local law enforcement to enforce, to pursue basically people whose only crime is being in the country without papers. And we would see a huge increase in racial profiling and a degradation of public health and safety. So a big no on Measure 105. And Measure 106 would be a backdoor ban on abortion by prohibiting the use of public funds for reproductive health care services. So that's a big no as well.
And then let's do the city measures.
Mm-hmm. Measure 26-199 is the Metro Affordable Housing Bond. So this is something that would open up an enormous pot of money to create permanently affordable housing units in the city and the metro city area.
Let's
not just
talk
Portland.
A little bit about that, because I think there's some confusion there. So first of all, that is going to be a tax.
I'm not sure exactly how the mechanism
okay.
works because
okay.
I'm not an expert on it. But yes, that is something that's going to increase fees just a little bit so that we can build literally thousands of permanently affordable housing units.
So what is that going to do to all these projects that are going up right now that look like they're going to be $1,500 for a studio, $2,000 for a one-bedroom apartment? These are not affordable. How do we
right.
guarantee that
right.
we're going to have affordable housing?
Well, one of the cool things I like about the Metro Housing Bond, 26-199, is that it could actually take existing property and remodel it and make it into permanently affordable housing, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be new construction. It can be retrofitting existing construction. Which is a very environmentally sound thing to do.
And this is a discussion I'm going to have on the show soon, because most of the people that I talk to when I've been canvassing are talking about the affordable mm-hmm. housing mm-hmm. crisis here. And it's
right.
very evident.
It's very important.
And it ties into homelessness and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's 26-201. I think we've been talking about that. So.
Well, we missed one real quick, though. 26-200
right,
is the Honest Elections campaign to limit campaign finance in the city, which I think is a really wise wise move. And then 26201, the Portland Clean Energy Initiative.
Are there any in the surrounding areas that we should know about for listeners outside of Portland?
I don't know about the ballot measures around there, unfortunately.
Yeah, I've been kind of busy and haven't been keeping up as much as I should. Well, any final things that we want to say about 26201 before you guys go out and go back to like the last day of campaigning?
Well, I guess I'll just say, and I'll let Patsy get a word in after I'm done. We are often told that a lie that it's jobs versus the environment. And that's what the Portland Business Alliance is trying to do right now. It's trying to pit you against your fellow Portlanders. Don't buy it. You know, the clean energy sector is one of the fastest growing energy sectors in the world. And it's time for low-income communities and communities of color to have access to those strong living wage jobs and the actual projects that come about from them. So that's why we're encouraging yes on 26201.
And Patsy?
Yeah, I'll just say that building healthy neighborhoods within our city is going to benefit us all, even those of us who already live in healthy neighborhoods, and increase the democratic impulse.
Well, Patsy and Damon, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for all the good work you're doing on Measure 26201.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
And we've been talking today with Damon Mott-Story, clean energy organizer, and Dr. Patricia Kohlberg, both with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we're going to be talking with Bob Salinger with the Audubon Society of Portland and Melanie Plout with Stop Fracked Gas PDX Coalition about the Portland Business Alliance's support of Jordan Cove, the infamous LNG export terminal proposed for the Coos Bay area. They're also their opposition to the Clean Energy Initiative here in Portland and other fossil fuel projects that they support around the Northwest. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. Thanks, Patsy, for your dual role today. I'm Barbara Brinstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Beatles. Thanks for listening.
Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right.